massive earthquake in Morocco has killed more than 2,000 people and is expected to rise, and buildings have been reduced to rubble following the devastating tremor on Friday.
Many Moroccans have been sleeping in the streets for fear of aftershocks destroying their already damaged homes.
Authorities in Greece are expressing concern over a possible outbreak of disease due to widespread flooding there.
But with dozens of villages and hamlets still stranded, all devoid of clean water and sewage, fears of further outbreaks grow.
And the G20 summit in New Delhi ended Sunday as India handed the bloc presidency to Brazil. Today is Monday, September 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. The death toll in Morocco has climbed past 2,000 following a massive earthquake late Friday. Buildings are reduced to rubble and survivors sleep outside for fear of dwellings falling around them. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
A security camera captures the moment a 6.8 magnitude earthquake struck Morocco as a man runs for his life through rubble. It was a common scene last Friday as the quake shook parts of this North African nation. Morocco's public broadcaster, SNRT, released images of cars crushed by rubble, highlighting the challenges facing rescue workers. Much of the quake's damage was in mountainous regions where villagers had already begun burying their dead as of Saturday. And as Moroccans and tourists visiting their country took part in blood drives at area clinics, Morocco's King Mohammed VI ordered the nation's armed forces to mobilize search and rescue teams. He also called for special prayer services Sunday at mosques. Many Moroccans have been sleeping in the streets for fear of aftershocks destroying their already damaged homes. The United States and others have offered support to the government and people of Morocco. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week.
We reached out immediately to the Moroccan government, made very clear to them that we are prepared to assist in any way that we can. We have the U.S. Agency for International Development, which takes the lead in our efforts. Mobilizing, and we're waiting to hear from the Moroccan government how we can be of most assistance. But we're tracking this very carefully, and our hearts go out to the people of Morocco who suffered this devastating earthquake, and we stand ready to help in any way that we can.
For those living through the disaster, their government's efforts have not gone unnoticed. Moroccan-American Mohamed Aitadi speaking with Reuters.
Authorities are doing their best, and even like in the high Atlas Mountains where people lost their lives and where that earthquake hit harder, they're trying to help. And I'm very sure that our people, our Moroccan people and our Moroccan community can get together and we can go through this.
Morocco has not seen this powerful an earthquake since 2004, when a magnitude 6.3 quake killed more than 550 people in one of the country's poorer regions. Morocco's worst earthquake in modern times happened in 1960. It destroyed most of the popular tourist destination of Agadir and killed at least 12,000 people. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Flash floods that have inundated central Greece due to Storm Daniel has left at least 12 people dead, with that number expected to rise. Anthi Karasava reports.
Chara Petropoulou pleads for assistance after Storm Daniel caused widespread flooding in central Greece. Help, she shouts to the anchor of a Sunday morning show. Please help. We may have survived the floods that drowned our towns and homes, she says, but the stench of decomposing animal carcasses, our chickens, our goats, rabbits and sheep, it is horrific and it is going to kill us, she adds. The wife of a farmer in the farming heartland of Greece, Petropoulou says she is left with no other option than to clean up the debris herself. I have a bottle of chlorine in my hand, she says, and I'm ready to head out into a meter of mud and floodwaters to clear out our chicken coop and to drag away the dead sheep the storm left behind. I have no other choice, she says. Petropoulou is not alone. Thousands of other farmers are following suit. But that is exactly what health authorities are warning against. Dysentery, diphtheria, and malaria are just some of the infectious diseases resulting from the floods that ravaged Thessaly, the farming heartland of Greece, and livestock for much of the past week. On Sunday, state health and veterinary officials said they had deployed dozens of special crews to collect dead livestock, taking decomposing carcasses to special incinerators to be burned. But with dozens of villages and hamlets still stranded, all devoid of clean water and sewage, fears of further outbreaks grow. Deputy Health Minister Irini Agapidaki. Authorities alone have been tasked with a cleanup of dead livestock, she told public television. People have to stay away from dead livestock, and those who have survived, goats, chickens, sheep, cows, even their pets, have to be steered clear and away from contaminated fields. The repercussions, she said, will be terrible. The looming health crisis adds to Daniel's destruction after walls of water pounded the Thessaly plain. Officials say over a four-day period, the storm drenched the affected area with more rainfall than London sees in a full year. On Sunday, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis toured the region to inspect recovery operations. He was expected to announce unprecedented aid measures in a late-night address. Locals, though, want more. They say the biggest but most pressing challenge is to rebuild the region to fortify it against future natural disasters and climate change. Anthika Rasava, VOA News, Athens.
U.S. President Joe Biden has held his highest-level direct talks in months with China. The talks came during the recent G20 summit of the world's largest economies held in New Delhi, India. VOA's State Department Bureau Chief, Nike Ching, has more.
In response to a question from VOA, U.S. President Joe Biden said he met with Chinese Premier Li Qiang while both attended the recent G20 summit hosted by India. At a news conference in Hanoi, Biden said Chinese President Xi Jinping's absence from the G20 talks may be a result of China's domestic economic crisis.
He has his hands full right now. He has overwhelming unemployment with his youth. One of the major economic tenets of his plan isn't working at all right now. I'm not happy for him that, but it's not working. So he's trying to figure out, I suspect, I don't know.
The U.S. leader said Washington does not want to contain China. Biden also said he doubts China's economic crisis would lead to an invasion of Taiwan. China considers Taiwan a wayward province and has never ruled out the use of military force to take full control of the self-governing territory.
I don't think it's going to cause China to invade Taiwan. As a matter of fact, the opposite, probably doesn't have the same capacity that it had before. But as I said, we're not looking to hurt China, sincerely.
The United States and Vietnam are elevating their relationship to that of a comprehensive strategic partnership, Hanoi's highest diplomatic status, as leaders from the two former rivals stand side by side. Washington and Hanoi still have disagreements over human rights issues, but China's sweeping territorial claims in the disputed South China Sea have been driving the U.S. and Vietnam closer, according to analysts.
So this isn't about picking the U.S. camp. It's about keeping the U.S. close to maintain balance with China. Vietnam views China on this issue the same way the U.S. does. That is, Vietnam views China as an aggressor, as a coercive, revisionist, rules-breaking power. And so when the U.S. talks about freedom of navigation and the rule of law, Vietnam fully agrees on this issue.
The U.S. is Vietnam's number one export market. Biden's visit will also boost trade and investment between the two countries as the U.S. tries to build a supply chain that is less reliant on China. Nike Chin, VOA News, Seoul.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. The G20 summit in New Delhi ended on Sunday as India handed the bloc presidency to Brazil. The group of 20, made up of leaders of industrial and emerging market nations, is welcoming the African Union as a permanent member. It is a powerful acknowledgement of Africa, as its more than 50 countries seek a more important role on the global stage. The White House is hailing this year's G20 summit as a success, saying the final communique contains consequential paragraphs on the war in Ukraine. VOA's Anita Powell reports from New Delhi.
Unity was what G20 leaders sought at this year's summit. And it's what they say they got, with language that called for a comprehensive, just, and durable peace in Ukraine, but that stopped short of naming Russia as the aggressor. The group also agreed that the use of nuclear weapons is inadmissible.
By removing the words Russia and the word aggression, they gave Mr. Putin a face-saving gesture. And we'll now wait and see if he then reciprocates by doing what all G20 members except him agree to, and that's getting out of all of Ukraine.
At the start of the New Delhi summit, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi urged consensus.
Today, as the president of G20, India calls upon the entire world to first convert this global trust deficit into faith. It is time for all of us to move together.
The wide-ranging agreement, which spanned issues like trade, economic growth and development, climate change, reform of multilateral institutions, technology, taxation, gender equality, and more, was reached on the first day of the meeting, despite the absence of Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping. Both were represented by senior officials. Washington's argument for supporting Ukraine hinged on the significant economic consequences of the conflict, the White House told VOA.
The war in Ukraine has put a huge strain on lower middle-income countries when it comes to food security, energy security, inflationary pressure. You can't discount the effect that Mr. Putin's war has had on the global economy. And what the president wants to pursue, and he'll mention the war in Ukraine specifically as he pursues this, are opportunities for these lower middle-income countries to be able to pursue investment opportunities and loans for infrastructure development that are high quality, that are transparent, and that will really meet their local needs as best as possible.
But Curtin said the leaders of the world's 20 premier economies could have been much bolder, especially concerning climate change.
We live in a world full of summits, G20, G7. We've got four UN summits to come in New York in the next few weeks. Joe Biden is planning a summit of the future next year. But what's the point if you just get these fine communiques, the fine promises too, we commit to, we agree, and then nothing gets done once the leaders go home.
President Joe Biden will first make a stop in Vietnam to strengthen ties with that nation before heading home to mark a day that has had grim resonance in the U.S. and beyond for 22 years, September 11th. Anita Powell, VOA News, New Delhi.
Two foreign aid workers were reportedly killed in eastern Ukraine on Sunday as Russian shelling hit a van carrying a team of four working with a Ukrainian non-governmental organization, while dozens of Russian drones targeted Kyiv and wounded at least one civilian. Russian authorities have reported multiple attempts to sabotage voting in local elections taking place in occupied areas of Ukraine. Niger's military leaders recently reopened the country's airspace to all commercial flights, ending a closure that had been in place since August 6th. But in a VOA exclusive, U.S. military officials tell VOA that the change to commercial flight access has not normalized U.S. drone flight frequencies. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has details.
U.S. officials tell VOA military drone flights out of bases in Niger have been limited since the coup in July. Niger is the U.S. military's hub for counterterror intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance in West Africa. U.S. drones launch from bases in Niger's capital and this airbase in Agadez, about 1,000 kilometers to the northeast. have provided eyes in the skies above the volatile Lake Chad Basin area of Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria. In recent years, Islamist militants have wreaked havoc on local populations.
The U.S. has limited capacity and limited resources and limited basing options in the region, and it's barely keeping a lid on the problem.
Limiting those drone missions, Raggio says, gives militants an advantage. That's because reducing intelligence and surveillance above impacts U.S. and partner forces' counterterror options on the ground, according to retired U.S. General Frank McKenzie, the former chief of U.S. Central Command.
It reduces your ability to find targets. It reduces your ability to go to the final stages when you're going to be able to attack them. It has a significant effect on the ability to conduct those kinds of operations. Significant.
U.S.-Niger security cooperation has been suspended since the July coup, and the Pentagon announced on Thursday it was repositioning some of its forces from Air Base 101 at the capital to Air Base 201 in Agadez.
There is no perceived threat in terms of any threat to U.S. troops, and no threat of violence on the ground. This is simply a precautionary measure.
The U.S. has some 1,100 U.S. military personnel inside Niger. U.S. officials say fewer than 100 have left since the coup began due to either medical issues or regularly scheduled mission rotations. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
President Biden will observe the 22nd anniversary of the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil at an Alaska military base with service members and their families. Nearly 3,000 people were killed in the attacks. Biden was a U.S. senator at the time. In October 2001, former U.S. President George W. Bush announced in a televised address that American forces were invading Afghanistan in what he termed carefully targeted actions designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
More than 2 weeks ago, I gave Taliban leaders a series of clear and specific demands. Close terrorist training camps, hand over leaders of the Al-Qaeda network, and return all foreign nationals, including American citizens unjustly detained in your country. None of these demands were met. And now, the Taliban will pay a price.
2 years ago, the United States withdrew from Afghanistan, and the Taliban once again took control of the country. Craig Albert, the graduate director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University, joined Steve Miller on VOA's Issues in the News to discuss global terrorism as Americans prepare to mark the anniversary.
So, Craig, where I want to begin is here. Where do you see the state of terrorism on the world stage, so to speak?
I see it almost to the same frequency and intensity as it was on 9/11. And the attacks in Africa have been horrific. They've increased in their intensity, frequency. The terribleness or just awfulness of what goes on in Africa from terrorism is just sickening to study as a political scientist. And the same as Iraq and Afghanistan, the Taliban does a better job today of controlling their media image, but, you know, they're still a terrorist organization and they carry out horrific events. And ISIS is once again rapidly on the rise in Iraq, really to the north of Baghdad, engaging in not just, you know, acts of terrorism, but full scale battles again against Iraqi national forces. And so one has to look back and say, you know, what has this past 20 years done against the war on terror? And really, the U.S. and NATO allies have been maintaining a low level of resistance for terrorism and pulling out on Afghanistan and other foreign policy decisions from former President Trump and President Biden has really lessened that intensity. And now terrorism, in my opinion, is starting to get back into a higher level of intensity and frequency and sophisticated, especially if you consider their cyber caliphates that multiple terrorist actors have.
And you've actually done a lot of research in cyber warfare, cyber attacks. Can you go into a little bit more detail about terrorist organizations and their use of cyber attacks?
Yeah, absolutely. ISIS is pretty sophisticated on this. There's some controversy out there about whether Russia mimics ISIS for a lot of the cyber caliphate attacks. There's definitely some instances where it was the GRU doing it. But today we know for sure of ISIS's steady consistency, not just with attempted cyber, physical cyber attacks against national infrastructure sites throughout Iraq, their attempts to get inside DOD, U.S. Department of Defense sites and do just defacing attacks, things of that. They haven't done anything real sophisticated that's open source to the United States. But the most concerning is there, of course, propaganda campaigns on social media. And that's really where my research has been focusing a lot in the past few years. And their propaganda skills are surpass many nation state actors with what they're capable of doing. They hire cyber engineers. They hire cyber social engineers. ISIS specifically does this. And they know how to target Western states, not just to install fear in Western states, but also for recruitment purposes. They still try to recruit people from the United States, people from France, Belgium, the UK, into ISIS causes. And that's very concerning that they're still able to successfully do this. And most Westerners, most Americans particularly, don't understand that ISIS has this presence on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, and then more on the Telegram platforms.
Craig Albert is the graduate director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University. Craig, thank you very much for your time this week.
Thanks so much.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 23rd, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, attempted to launch a spy satellite into space. The launch of the carrier rocket violated United Nations Security Council resolutions that banned any launches by North Korea using ballistic technologies. The DPRK's ballistic missile program, which is part of its continued pursuit of weapons of mass destruction, poses a threat to international peace, stability, and security. One of the major obstacles to DPRK's ballistic missile development is lack of funding. Beginning in 2006, after North Korea performed its first nuclear test, a number of countries and international bodies, including the United States, imposed international sanctions against its government. Today, most sanctions imposed on North Korea are tailored to hinder its nuclear weapons program, including the means to finance it. In the wake of the failed launch on August 23rd, OFAC, the United States Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, designated John Jin Yong, Sergei Mikhailovich Kozlov, and Intellect LLC, pursuant to Executive Order 13,687, for their involvement in generating revenue for the Democratic People's Republic of Korea's unlawful development of weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missiles. John Jin Yong, who is based in Russia, was designated for being an official of the Workers' Party of Korea, which was sanctioned on March 15, 2016. John Jin Yong worked with Sergei Mikhailovich Kozlov to coordinate the use of North Korean construction workers in Russia. He also led a team of North Korean information technology workers in Russia and worked with Russian nationals to obtain identification documents to validate his team's accounts on freelance IT work platforms. Sergei Mikhailovich Kozlov assisted John Jin Yong in the procurement of items commonly used in the shipbuilding industry. Kozlov was designated for materially assisting, sponsoring or providing financial, material, or technological support for, or goods or services to, or in support of, John Jin Yong. OFAC designated Intellect LLC for being owned or controlled by Kozlov. The U.S. Treasury Department is targeting supporters of the DPRK's weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs, including those who help finance it. The United States will continue to implement and enforce existing sanctions while urging the DPRK to return to a diplomatic path and abandon its pursuit of weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missiles.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.